You're listening to New Voices in Philosophy,
a production of the Extending New Narratives in the History of Philosophy project.
This podcast is sponsored by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada and partner institutions.
I'm Lin Nan.
And I'm Jacinta Shrimpton. In this episode, I talk with Kristen Yazdal, Professor of Philosophy at Temple University. We discuss the 19th century philosopher Germaine de Staël, focusing mainly on works she published in the late 1790s. Our discussion covers Staël's distinctive account of the passions, her thoughts on happiness, and how her understanding of fanaticism is illuminating for our modern political era. We also talk about the methodological challenges Yazdal has faced while researching Staël, which culminates at the end of the episode with some valuable advice to students about how to research understudied figures. The second half of the episode includes a discussion about Staël's abolitionism with a focus on Mirza, an abolitionist novella that was published alongside Staël's Essay on Fictions. This is intended to guide the reader in their approach to the novellas. Finally, the discussion turns to the existentialist themes that run throughout Staël's works, and Yazdal marks Staël out as potentially being the first existentialist.
So I'm Kristen Yazdal. I'm a professor of philosophy at Temple University in Philadelphia. I work broadly on modern European philosophy, but right now, this past, half a year or so, I've started to work on a more focused project on Germaine de Staël that will, I hope, culminate in a very short overview book that covers all of her philosophy, and then a more focused monograph that deals with her theory of selfhood, her conception of the I, the human I.
Wow. Well, I'm looking forward to being able to read those. But thank you so much, Kristen, for joining us on the podcast. Really looking forward to talking to you today. So could you share a bit about who Germaine de Staël was and how you became interested in her?
Well, once you know who she is, it's very hard not to get interested in her. That I can say. She is a formidable philosopher, and she is somebody who really unifies the periods of the Enlightenment, Romanticism, and idealism on the one hand, and the philosophical landscapes in France, Germany, England, and maybe even Russia on the other. So she's a very synthesizing person, philosopher, who starts publishing philosophy at age 22. Her first philosophy book was A Study of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. It was published in 1788, meaning she was born in 1766.
And so with such a worldwide audience, you mentioned Russia, Germany, France, was she writing for any group in particular, or did she really have the masses in mind when she was writing her philosophy? She was aiming it at everyone.
That's an interesting question. So her first book, The Study of Rousseau, was published anonymously. She was, in a way, world famous even before she started writing. She was famous because of her parents. So she came from a home that was immensely privileged. Her father was the Minister of Finance in France, a Swiss family, but they managed to get quite well integrated in France. Her mother had hosted a very well-known salon, and the young Germaine Necker, as was her name at the time, she was known to be the richest heiress in Europe. So people knew about her, and then she starts writing philosophy, first anonymously. Who does she write for? She writes, I think, for an educated audience in France in the beginning. But it is clear that she includes in this audience not just the educated men, but also educated women. And then as her publishing empire, so to speak, expands, she publishes more and more books, and I'm sure we'll talk about those in a bit, and her books get translated. And at that point, she's really writing for an international audience in a way that I think it's safe to say few philosophers did at the time.
And given her popularity and her renown as a philosopher at the time, how is it possible that up until recently she's been relatively forgotten in curriculums and scholarship? How is there such a kind of stark forgetting of Stahl?
Yeah, that's a question that applies to so many women in philosophy. But with Jamanda Stahl, it is important to remember that she was well known in her time and after her time. So she was well known, I think it is safe to say, well into the 1880s, 1890s, early 1900s, perhaps even. And I've come across references to her in her own time. We find references to her as a philosopher in book reviews, for example, especially in England, more so in England than in France, I think. But then I was working on Henrik Ibsen, the playwright, in his works from the late 1800s. And I found references to Jamanda Stahl in his work. And he was progressive. He was somebody who thought a lot about women's rights, who might even have used one of Jamanda Stahl's literary characters as, or had her in mind when he wrote his Dollhouse, his most well-known play. So we know for sure that she was well-known way after her death. And the question then is, what happened? And with Jamanda Stahl, as with so many of the figures, the women figures, the women philosophers in her period, it seems like they were read and appreciated until the 1910s, the 1920s, which corresponds with the time period when women could get a higher secondary or university education. So around the same time, we don't know if there is a causal connection here, but around the same time that women could finally get their magisters or MAs or even PhDs, that's the time period when women philosophers in general, including Stahl in particular, get pushed out, as it were, or marginalized within the canon.
So let's turn now to your chapter, Jamanda Stahl on Passions, Politics, and Fanaticism. There you detail Stahl's account of the passions, drawing primarily from her 1796 treatise titled On the Influence of the Passions Upon the Happiness of Individuals and of Nations, quite a title. What is distinctive about de Stahl's account of the passions?
Thanks for asking that question. So this is, as I see it, her first very ambitious philosophical text. So it's published 8 years after she published her work on Rousseau. She'd published Political Theory, she'd published Political Reflections, and she had published 3 abolitionist novellas and an essay on literature. But now she decides, 1796, or a little bit earlier, obviously, because she had to write the book, to write a study of the human passions. It was a grand project she had in mind. She had in mind a two-part, two-volume essay that would deal with the consequences or effects of the human passions on individual lives, our individual happiness, on the one hand, this was volume one, and on social and political life, our collective being, on the other. That was volume two. She only finished volume one. So we have the part of her study that deals with the effects of the passions on our individual lives. Now, she writes in a time where the passions was a hot philosophical issue. Today, or question, we don't talk about the passions to the same extent today, but as I see it, this is moral psychology. This is Stahl's moral psychology in its first form. And she talks about how human self-determination, our ability to follow what we know with our reason is the best path, how this ability is constantly threatened by the passions. The passions, she claims or suggests, is they are powerful. They're like a tornado. We might have plans that are perfectly good, perfectly reasonable. We know what's the right thing to do in order to be good at our jobs, have successful lives, be good parents, what have you, be good in politics. We know which path we're supposed to follow. And then something happens. We fall in love. We get envious. We get ambitions. We get all sorts of passions that overwhelm us. And we steer or veer off track. And this is, as she sees it, a constant battle between our reason and our passions. And it's a great source of unhappiness. Mm.
I want to pick up on something that you were saying there. She seems incredibly concerned throughout her philosophical works with the impact of the political on the self, and also how it kind of intertwines with philosophy. So I was wondering if you could speak about a little bit about the political context that she was writing in.
So she was writing in a time period when France and Europe experienced some great political upheavals. During the French Revolution, during Napoleon Bonaparte's long reign, and then during the post-Napoleonic restructuring of the European map. She was from around 1802, maybe 1804, one of Napoleon's arch enemies. She was exiled from Paris, then from France, for a period of more than 10 years. So, and she had to leave during the Reign of Terror. She spent parts of that period in England. So if we're speaking about biography, her biography, it is clear that politics had a lot to say. She couldn't live in her home. She couldn't live in her house for 10 years. She had to take her children out traveling through Europe. She spent parts of this period in Switzerland. So from a purely biographical standpoint, politics really determines her life. But she also speaks in more general philosophical terms. She thinks, for example, that the situation of both men and women, of each individual, is different in a monarchy than it is in a republic. A republic is virtue-oriented. It's oriented, as she sees it, towards individual perfectionism, performance. And in a republic, it is even more important that everyone gets a chance to stand forth as a shining exemplar. This goes for men and women, in her view. What happens in the republics of Europe at the time? Well, the women do not get a chance to be part of public life. So politically, the structure has changed by all intellectual standards. Women's roles should have changed, and yet they haven't. And this is, of course, something that she ends up thinking a great deal about.
I do want to revisit that a bit later during our chat together, especially so that we can get into Stahl's chapter titled On Women Writers. But for now, I wanted to ask what Stahl wrote on fanaticism, which also seems to play a key role in her account of the passions and is urgently addressing the political issues of her time, such as the Reign of Terror. And so could you tell us a bit about her fanaticism and how it differs from other conceptions of fanaticism that were prevalent, if there were any others at the time?
Yes, I'm happy to talk about that. So in her study of the passions, as we now have it, the first part, which was planned as the first part, fanaticism plays a key role. And it seems like the way she had thought of her two-volume project, fanaticism would be a bridge from the focus on the individual to the focus on the social. She writes about fanaticism as the strongest and most destructive of the passions. She writes about political engagement as being something good. Party spirit being one-sidedly obsessed with a political program, on the other hand, is not necessarily a good thing. But what's really bad for her is when an affiliation to a political party or program turns blind and we start following without reflecting the guidelines, actions, imperatives, often of one strong leader. And we start desiring the guidelines, the pathos of this great leader in quotation marks. And I was reading this book for the first time when the former president of the United States, Trump, was still in office, and reading Jomindo Stahl's description of fanaticism from 1796 and then seeing what happened in the United States on the 6th of January when during the transition of power was quite amazing. She offers, as I see it, a phenomenally relevant analysis of fanaticism. And getting back to your question, one of the things that makes this analysis so relevant is that she is interested in political fanaticism. Voltaire, for example, had been interested in religious fanaticism. For Jomindo Stahl, it's primarily political fanaticism, independently of what position you take.
And that's great. So that touches on another question I wanted to ask, which was basically, what can her account of fanaticism reveal about our world today? And so you've seen the parallels with her work and the former American president, the sort of political atmosphere at the time. Would you be able to draw that out even further? Perhaps the prescience of her account?
Well, she is doing a couple of things. She's looking at the individual needs that are met in submitting more or less passively, naively, to a group, to a headless monster, as it were, that is just acting on the words of the leader. And she is talking about how people who are subject to fanaticism, and she thinks in a way this is a risk for all of us. It's not a certain group of people that wear post-it stickers on their backs and they're prone to fanaticism and the rest of us can be on our high horses and we're not vulnerable. She thinks we're all prone to fanaticism. And the risk, as she sees it, is at an individual level when you experience a loss of meaning, a sense that there is no place for you in politics, in public life, when politics is threatened or has even collapsed. These are the volatile moments, historically speaking and existentially speaking, where fanaticism can develop.
So fanaticism is actually, for her, something that's natural, not unnatural. And it's something that it's not simply the individual who is responsible for it, but also the social and political structures around them have somehow failed them. So would that be an accurate representation of what's happening there?
Yes and no. I mean, it's accurate in the sense that the fanatic individual will often feel that society has failed. But we all have a responsibility for ourselves. So we need to take responsibility for our own actions, no matter what historical context, political context we're thrown into. But with certain kind of political or within certain kind of political contexts, we are more prone to fanaticism. And those contexts are not necessarily contexts for which we as individuals are responsible.
Yeah. And I find it interesting that she distinguishes fanaticism against the other passions, because it seems as though the other passions as well can be destructive or helpful for society beyond just the self. And it also seems that societies shape selves. Just briefly returning to her chapter on women writers, it seems as though she goes through a number of scenarios in which different political structures can shape at least the female self. And it seems that part of the answer to balancing one's passions are the sorts of relationships one has with others. So why is the political and the social more emphasized with fanaticism, but not so with the other passions?
I guess the answer to that would be that the other passions, such as love or addiction to gaming or substances. She actually does discuss that, and her husband was addicted to gaming, which made it good news for him that she was such wealthy when the two of them married.
And a moral psychologist.
So, yeah. So, you know, fanaticism finds a home in political life as she sees it. And it's a passion that is, that develops or escalates when the political conditions are ripe for it. So it is a passion that only develops, as she sees it, under certain political conditions. But then again, her answer to her cure, her remedy to all of the passions is at the end of the day. It's not, she doesn't claim that this remedy is necessarily successful, but the best we have is to to try and forget ourselves a little bit and be there for others. Compassion. Compassion is a great remedy to the passions in general.
Yeah, so she says, she speaks about study and philosophy being kind of ways of strengthening the self against fanaticism, but she seems to think that compassion is really the key there, away from the fanatical mindset. And she says it seems that compassion is a virtue. And so what I found interesting is that fanaticism has often has a virtuous core, but compassion as a virtue is something which can combat that sort of mindset. Would you talk about that a little bit?
Well, she makes it clear that out of all the passions, fanaticism is the most difficult one to handle. So when she presents her, what can we call it? Her like passion detox program. she discusses the importance of friends, the importance of family to overcome the passions is something that that requires often the help and support of others. She discusses the role of philosophy and study, but which can be great. It can make you more reflective. It can make you more thoughtful. It can make you more reasonable. But she says that's not for everyone. It's not like you can come out on January 6th in Washington, D.C. with a bunch of Immanuel Kant books and hope to make a difference. That's not the way it works. She thinks that this is helpful for some individuals, not for others. But as a rule, she says, the experience of other kinds of self-loss, of belonging to a community that's more productive than a community of fanatics, let's say, is going to be where she puts her trust.
Mm-hmm. And so the other side as well of this treatise is happiness. It's there in the title. So it indicates that it's going to be a key focus, but she declines to give a definition of happiness. But I mean, you've characterized it as including an appropriate level of self-governance and this compassionate connection with others. So in what sense would that be an incomplete picture of happiness for Stahl?
She writes about happiness throughout her work. She's obsessed with happiness. I mentioned that how she combines the different movements in late 18th century philosophy, the Enlightenment, Romanticism, Idealism. She is a romantic in the sense that she really is interested in human longings, desires, and hopes. And the ultimate thing that we humans are hoping for is, as she sees it, happiness. She writes about happiness a little bit, as you say, in the discussion of, in her treatise on the passions. She writes about it in her 1813 Reflections on Suicide, which is more of an existentialist treatise as I see it. It's a question of the meaning of, she discusses the meaning of life, the feeling of meaningfulness in your life. And with happiness, she seems to follow two distinct routes, and she's wanting to combine them. On the one hand, happiness, already in the essay on the passions, is related to self-governance. On the other hand, and this filters through, but it's not as clear in the essay on the passions as it is in 1813, for example. On the other hand, it's clear that we need more than just being reasonable, self-governing beings. We need a sense of purpose. We need to feel that our lives are meaningful. We need to have close relationships to other human beings. We need love. We need friendship. All of that is required for us to lead fulfilled human lives. So it seems that self-determination, self-governance is or some extent of self-governance is a necessary condition. But you don't fall in love, she will say, unless you also lose self-governance. You just don't want to lose too much of it or lose it for too long of a time.
And so is this your reconstruction of happiness, or does she come quite close to giving a definition, even if she declines to do that?
Well, parts of why she declines is that she is a bit of a historicist. So people lead different lives in different cultures. She's really interested in German culture. She's interested in English culture. She's a comparativist. She likes to investigate the role of women, for example, with respect to certain cultures. How do women's roles differ in different cultures? And I think the same goes with happiness. What makes you and me happy today in 2024 might be different from what would make a philosophically inclined woman happy in 1796.
And so in terms of reconstructing Stahl's account of happiness, of the passions, what were some interpretive and methodological challenges you faced, including other texts of hers, which you may have drawn in?
Well, one challenge is that she often talks about other philosophers without mentioning their names. She's not the only one who does that. Johann Gottfried Herder in Germany at the same time, somebody Germain de Stael whose philosophy Germain de Stael was interested in, does the same. So her philosophical discourses often develop. They're with certain individuals in mind, but she doesn't give you the names, she doesn't give you the works. So with her discussion of the passions, for example, it's clear that Voltaire is one of her targets, Adam Smith, probably. She's influenced by him. She's read Hume at this point. She's read less German philosophy in this period than she had later on. But it's when you're unpacking these dense philosophical texts, often written in a pretty flowery language, moving between the more personal and a more academic prose, it would have made it a lot easier if she would have been more forthright with the philosophers she is actually discussing.
Mm. Mm-hmm. And otherwise, did you find her thought quite systematic, or was it a challenge to kind of build something that we might be more familiar with in philosophical texts?
I think that depends on what you mean by a system.
Mm-hmm.
I would say she's systematic, but she doesn't believe in a philosophy that seeks to culminate in a system in the way, let's say, Hegel at the same time aspires to. Again, I think that has to do with her sense of history, her sense of cultural differences, her more Socratic understanding of philosophy. So I find her systematic, but not a system thinker, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I understand. And kind of along the same vein, you've written elsewhere that Stahl and other women philosophers of her era were original thinkers whose contributions can't be summed up under any ism starting with the name of a male colleague. So thinking along those lines, what would be some key features we would find in a Stahlism philosophy, or are there any male philosophers that fall under Stahlist thought?
Are there? Yeah. Well, maybe there are. At least there are male philosophers who were extremely interested in her work. There is, for example, Georg Brandes, who's often credited with with discovering Friedrich Nietzsche's philosophy. He was really influenced by Germain de Staël, and probably the reason why somebody like Henrik Ibsen read her work in the 1880s and 90s. So that would be one example. She clearly makes an impression on Wilhelm von Humboldt, who meets her in Paris early on, writes back to Goethe, for example, about this woman whose work Goethe ought to read ASAP. And Goethe then later translates her essay on fiction. She corresponds with Jacobi. She meets Schelling. She meets Fichte. She doesn't get along with Fichte very well. Does she have an ism? I don't know. She has an original position. Does she influence the male philosophers in her time period? I think yes, but I also do think that philosophy has a conversational aspect where she influences other philosophers and she gets influenced by their works.
Mm-hmm. Great. So I would like to return to something you actually mentioned earlier, which was her abolitionist novellas. So could you speak a little bit about her views on abolitionism, what precipitated them, how they developed?
Happy to do that. So we're still then, just for the listeners, we're still dealing with what we can call the young Germain de Staël.
Okay.
So the work on passions, the treatise on the passions, was published in 1796, the year before she published three abolitionist novellas, a collection of three novellas, two of which have an explicit abolitionist theme. There is a lot to say about her abolitionism, so I'll try to be structured here. The first thing to know about the novella, the three novellas, is that they were written, she claims, early on, around the time when she published her work on Rousseau, and then only published in 1795. When she publishes them, she publishes them with an essay on fiction. The essay on fiction is a flaming pamphlet, 1795, for political and philosophical literature. And remember, 95, that's 5 years exactly after Kant had published his Critique of the Power of Judgment, arguing for the autonomy of the pure aesthetic judgment. Germaine de Staël knew Kant's work. She worked her way into Kant's work. But in 95, she publishes this defense of a philosophical, possibly political, engaged literature. This is big news for somebody like Georg Brandes and will actually influence the whole realist movement of realist literature in Europe. But it's a clue. It's a clue to the reader that even though these three novellas are examples of literature, I mean, they are novellas, they're not philosophical treatises, they should be read with a philosophical mindset. And this, I think, is important because when you read novellas, especially the most well-known of them with the name Mirza, the title Mirza, it's easy, if you read them as literature, you will focus on the plot, you will focus on this Senegalese woman, Mirza, who sacrifices herself for her beloved one when he's about to be sold to some European slave traders. She will say, take me instead. My life is worthless without my beloved, so I might as well go into enslavement. And then this the European slave trader will say, any European will blush at having you as in enslavement, so you're both free. And then Mirza goes on to kill herself because she can't have a life with her beloved one. So if you read it as literature, it is, I don't know, somewhat interesting. It's all about suffering and self-sacrifice, a woman's suffering, a woman's self-sacrifice. Interesting enough. But if you follow her pamphlet, if you follow her how to read, you see how she layers the novella. There are three different people here. It's the European traveler who tells the story, who's met the lover, Simeo. It's Simeo, the lover, who was, after all, not sold to enslavement. And it's Mirza, the heroine. And if you read this philosophically, you can see the different layers of argumentation. And you can see how each of them presents a position that is quite different, and Mirza being the most radical of the three of them in her philosophical views.
And so what's so radical about Mirza's position in the novel? What's the philosophical argument that Stahl is making with Mirza's role there?
She makes several arguments, as I see it. So Simeo, the lover whom she's trying to save, he ends up working for the European governor with a lot of melancholy and resentment. So he's somebody who is freed only to keep working for the Europeans under their premises, in freedom, but he's still working. He's not setting the premises for his own life. He's working with and living with somebody else's values, if you see what I mean. Mirza is clear that this is not the worth life living. She's clear that this is not real freedom. And she's also very clear in the way she picks apart the ethos, the ideals of the European Enlightenment. She will use her Enlightenment ideas that in the novella she has been taught by a Frenchman residing in Senegal for a while. I mean, there are tons of cliches in this novella. When you read it, it's kind of unpleasant. And it's not shocking given the time period, but you would have hoped for more. But Mirza then picks apart the Enlightenment ideas. She shows how the ideals of freedom, of liberty, fraternity, equality are not worth anything if this is liberty, fraternity, inequality amongst white male citizens only. So she positions herself through a series of philosophical arguments that both offer criticism of the Enlightenment ideals, the revolutionary ideals, and an interesting discussion of the relationship between freedom, sacrifice, work even. Those are all concepts that people with an interest in Hegel, the phenomenology of spirit, the famous discussion of the master bondsman's dialectics, will recognize. Stahl writes much earlier. Her discussion is relevant for our understanding of Hegel, but her position is different, very different from Hegel's.
And so why did she decide that these novellas were the best vehicle for her arguments, as opposed to something like a treatise or an essay?
Who knows? I mean, she was very young at the time. Writing novellas was more acceptable for a woman, that's clear. There was an abolitionist literature at the time. There was an abolitionist discourse at the time, which was predominantly, some scholars say, male. There was an abolitionist literature that was predominantly female. But intriguing thing here is the essay, the How to Read, that is published with the three novellas. She positions herself with an eye to the abolitionist literature. The figure of Mirza was well known at the time. She borrows that figure for her own purposes. But this is 1795. And then when Napoleon reestablishes slavery, I mean, no nation had done that, abolished slavery only to establish it. So slavery was abolished in France, and we're talking about an economy where two-thirds of the foreign trade was directly harvested from the sugar, or related to the sugar production in Haiti, so in the Caribbean. Slavery is abolished and then reintroduced. So around 1804, we see her being quite active, not writing so much, but being quite active in terms of her contacts, trying to discuss to stop this reintroduction of slavery. And then during the discussions in Vienna of the map of post-Napoleonic Europe, slavery came up again. Should slavery be abandoned in Europe and the European colonies? And Stahl fought quite hard in this period. And now she publishes essays. And she even writes to Thomas Jefferson to try and have him abolish slavery in the U.S. So, well, not essays, that's wrong. She publishes an introduction to a work, a translation of a work by Wilberforce, a British abolitionist. His work was translated into French. She writes the introduction, and then she writes letters. And she tries to get Humboldt to suggest in Vienna that slavery should be abolished. But he thinks this is unstrategic because slavery is, the abolitionist movement is too closely related to the Jacobins. So a radical political position.
And so then it wasn't only the novellas in which we find her abolitionist work. It was really part of a multi-pronged attack from Stahl.
Yes, and that runs through her entire life. But what we haven't talked about is that when her marriage was originally when she was getting married, this was international politics. The queen was involved. Many partners, many future husbands were considered. William Pitt, later prime minister in the UK, was considered. She didn't particularly like him as a husband. But Erich von Holstein-Stahl was then seen as a suitable candidate. He was a diplomat, so some degree of diplomatic immunity. He also had a title. He would make her a baronet. So he was a suitable candidate. And the terms of the marriage were then negotiated between Sweden and France. And as part of these negotiations, I'm not sure if this was part of the terms of marriage or part of the larger negotiations, but France gave Sweden one of their Caribbean islands, so that Sweden now were part of the colonial economy in the Caribbean. So Germaine de Staël had the experience of being sold, as it were. I don't know, that's a strong term, but she was given away, and the price that was paid for this young bride was, in part, an island whose economy was mainly slave-based.
That is wild. And evidently, she did not take that well. She was quite against it. So would you say that's the point at which she really became a committed abolitionist, or was she one before that moment? Could we know?
Hard to know, because we don't. She didn't write anything before that.
Okay.
So... I don't know.
All right. Well, in the interest of time, I want to return to something that you mentioned a little while back, which is existentialism, and also a chapter that we've referenced a couple of times on women writers. So there, Stahl details numerous ways in which various societies and political structures can suppress and damage women. And I was really struck reading that by how her writing seemed to prefigure some of Simone de Beauvoir's work in The Second Sex. So I was wondering if Stahl was an influence for Beauvoir or any other existentialists?
Good question. She's mentioned quite a few times, a dozen times or so, in the second sex. And as we know, when the second sex was first translated into English, most of Beauvoir's references to women thinkers were simply taken out. They were deleted. I can't remember exactly how many it was, like 75 or 57 or something like that, but a great deal of references to women thinkers and writers were just taken out, eliminated in the English translation. Now, of course, they're included, but make sure you read a newer translator.
I will.
But of, you know, one of the women who features in the second sex is Germaine de Staël. Every now and then she's mentioned. But she's mentioned mostly for the examples she sets, the way she lived out her identity as a modern woman. But when you read Germaine de Staël's discussion of women in her 1800 study of literature, which is the work you're referring to, so after the study of passions, after her essay on fiction, she writes this big comparative study of literatures. And there is a chapter there on intellectual women, women who write. Both in that context and in her novel, her very big and famous novel, Corinne or Italy, from 1807, same year as Hegel published his Phenomenology of Spirit. Both these two works, she is really interested in how women have different opportunities in different cultures. This is super interesting because she clearly, in those works, anticipates a view where you're shaped as a woman rather than being born with an essence that determines your entire life path. So we find some essentialism, gender essentialism, in her work, but we also find an awareness of how a culture, how not only nature but also nurture, will determine the existential possibilities of and political possibilities of a woman.
And so how much of her work was the existentialist theme running through?
As I see it, she has, you know, she might well be the first existentialist. This is before Søren Kierkegaard, or whoever you want to call the first modern existentialist. I don't know how much sense it makes to look for the first existentialist, but she's certainly a contender. I would say there is an existentialist orientation in all of her work. Her orientation towards freedom, towards the self, towards what it is to be a self, what it takes to be a self. The balance, the impossible balance almost, between the freedom we experience and crave and the situation we're thrown into, to use a formulation from Sartre and Beauvoir. That all of that we find throughout her entire work. The reflections on suicide from 1813 is, as I see it, maybe her most existentialist work. So that's something I'm working on at the moment, actually, to write a shorter piece on what I think is her existentialism, especially in that piece.
And so what's lost if Staël is not taught in existentialist curriculums?
Well, I don't think she has been taught much. I'm hoping to teach existentialism next academic year again. It's one of my standard classes, and I usually start with Hegel in the Master-Bondsmann's dialectics, and then move on to Kierkegaard and Sartre and Beauvoir and Fanon and others. But this time I'm definitely going to start with Germaine de Staël. So I think the question will have to be, what is gained?
Yes, okay.
By adding her, and ask me in a year's time, and I hope I will have an answer. But I think one of the things that come to mind just immediately and without having thought this properly through is that gender is part of existentialism right from the beginning. It's not something that's added on towards the end by Simone de Beauvoir. Existentialism, the systematic philosophical thinking about the human self, human freedom, the relationship between our freedom and our the context we're thrown into, of course that gender is part of that thinking. How could it not be? And add Jomendus Dahl to our understanding of existentialism, and we see that this clearly is the case.
Have you taught Dahl before?
Yes, I have. I have taught her. I have a class called Unruly Women, where I teach only 19th century philosophy. That class begins with Jomendus Dahl. I have also taught a class on Hegel's aesthetics and Jomendus Dahl's aesthetics. So I just split the semester in half and taught, spent half of the time on Hegel's aesthetics, half of the time on Dahl. That was a fun class, and some really, really good student essays came out of it. So there we have two reactions to Kant, as it were, quite different. So instead of having this monumental history of first we have Kant and autonomy aesthetics, then we have Hegel's reaction, his historicizing of art, ending with the end of great art, as he dramatically puts it, we have different ways of responding to Kant, where Hegel is reduced to one possible response. With Jomendus Dahl, we have a very different understanding of art, of literature. She doesn't think it will come to an end. She doesn't think that our deepest longings will be replaced by philosophical discourse. There is always a room for art, but still, like Hegel, she thinks that art is about truth. It's about the way in which we humans express what means the most to us.
Mm. What's the student's response to Dahl when you're teaching her, especially with that framework of Kant and Hegel?
In that particular framework, I think usually the response is enthusiastic. She's a very arrogant writer, and that can be annoying. It can be annoying for all of us, not just the students, for me teaching her too. But it's not like she's the only arrogant 19th century philosopher. I mean, that's, there is quite a deal of competition there. But the most pressing problem, and I really, really hope something can be done about that, because there is a way to fix it, is the translations. She was popular in her lifetime. She was translated in her lifetime, and she hasn't been translated since very much. There is an anthology of her work. There is an updated version of her discussion of the revolution. But those central philosophical works, we need new translations. We need new translations into English so that we can, in a responsible way, bring this into our classrooms without presupposing that the students master French.
So this is a good segue to our final question, because that seems like, for anyone who has an interest in researching Dahl, that seems like a great place to start, is working on a translation of all of these texts, which need to be updated for English readers and perhaps other language readers as well.
Yes, that is much needed. Good introductions, good translations. And there are so many series these days with translations of works from French and German. And if you look at the names they include, it's a little depressing. Very few works by women philosophers are included.
Mm. Well, with that in mind, what would be your advice to students who are researching or want to research either Dahl or an understudied figure such as her?
Well, I do have quite a few students who've done it and been very successful in both getting their work published and getting their works and getting a tenure track job. So one of the things I would say is, don't be intimidated. If you're interested in doing it, do it, but do it thoughtfully and carefully, and make sure you get your work published in good places. And make sure you're in an environment where this kind of work is respected and supported. It's going to be challenging. It's challenging to work on any figure, no matter what gender, who's marginalized in the tradition. Of course, there are many male figures who are also marginalized in the philosophical canon. And working on those figures is always going to be challenging, but it's also going to be immensely rewarding. Mm-hmm.
Great advice. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Kristen, and sharing your knowledge. I'm very excited to share this episode with the audience.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for having so many good and thoughtful questions and comments.
Thank you for listening to New Voices in Philosophy.
Production of the podcast is funded by the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada as part of the Extending New Narratives in the History of Philosophy project. This episode was produced by me, Jacinta.
The music you hear is by 17th century female composer Elisabeth Claude Jaguet de la Guerre. It is Sonata No. 2 in D major, performed on the violin by Bitteria Armanici.
For more information about the project and for future episodes, please visit our website, newnarrativesinphilosophy.net.
We look forward to discussing these new figures and ideas with you.